Too much salt can drive up blood pressure and increased risk for stroke and heart disease, two leading causes of death in the U.S. Most Americans eat more than double the amount of salt recommended by experts. It can come from places other than the salt shaker, in canned goods like soup, and packaged foods like frozen dinners. It's also hiding in breads and cereals. Read food labels, enjoy more fresh fruits and vegetables, and look for low-sodium alternatives. For more information, visit www.cdc.gov. A message from CDC.
Good morning and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. I'm your host, Joy Keyes, and I want to thank you for listening this morning. This is a special edition. It's not Saturday, it's Sunday, but I want to thank you for your support, getting close to 81,000 downloads of the podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at Joy Keyes. You can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes and send me an email. I would love to hear from you. My email address is SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. This morning, I have a powerhouse health guru with me. He's a Southern man, and he is very motivated and concerned about the health of Americans, and he wrote a new book. It's called Information is the Best Medicine, and I agree with that statement, so I wanted to have him on the show. And a mutual friend of ours actually prompted me and said, hey, you know this guy, you better get him on the show, you know, kind of berating me like, hey, come on, get with the program. So good morning, Glenn Ellis.
Hi, Joy. How are
you? I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for agreeing to do the interview this morning.
It is an absolute pleasure. I am so thrilled and as well as honored to be able to share some time with your
listeners. Well, I want to tell my listeners a little bit about you. You lecture in the U.S. and abroad. You have a weekly radio broadcast that's heard in 53 U.S. markets and 53 countries. You've been in Real Health Magazine, Black AIDS Institute newsletter, also Healthy Living Magazine. You are a member of the review staff of the American Journal of Public Health, the Association of Healthcare Journalists, and a founding editor-at-large for blackdoctor.org. So I just want to give them a little background on you, let them know you do know what you're talking about, and you know, flim-flam artist, so to speak.
No, not at all.
I want to let them know about your website also. It's glennellis.com. Also, you're on Twitter. Is your Twitter hook Glenn Ellis?
Well, it's at Glenn Ellis.
At Glenn Ellis Sr.
SR.
Okay, so you want to follow him to get updates about what he's doing. You're doing a show, or a reading, I should say. I say show, but you're doing a reading next Sunday on the 19th, correct?
That's correct. Actually, you know what I'm going to be doing, Joy, is in addition to, you know, really doing some stuff with the book directly, I'm going to do a real focused presentation that significantly impacts the commemoration of Black History Month. So I've got a presentation that I'll be doing to look at the history of African Americans and medicine and health in Philadelphia, the 1790s, when the yellow fever epidemic almost decimated Philadelphia and brought it all the way up to present. Medicine has impacted it from a point of view of the kind of doctor disbursement and the basic disappearance of Black doctors all the way down to the kind of Black hospitals, mm-hmm. and just to look at how our health care and our health has really kind of like followed a path, and as we'll see, it really, obviously the numbers now show that it really has been a continuous spiral downward when we look at what some of our outcomes are today. So I'm going to do that presentation along with a presentation of readings from the book itself.
Well, definitely. I mean, we Black people in America and people of color in America are usually at the short end of the stick in terms of their health, no matter if it's diabetes, asthma, cancer, autoimmune, lupus, multiple sclerosis. They're at the short end of the stick for a number of reasons, and you bring those up in your book. And then historically, the Tuskegee, you know, experiments. Recently, people started learning about Henrietta Lacks and how her body parts, literally in a sense, her cells and things were used for research without her family's permission. So there's a negative history with people of color and the healthcare industry, but people like you, you're a man of color, I'm a woman of color, there are a lot of wonderful African Americans in the science and medicine industry now, and they are able to succeed and offer help, but it's just not enough. And people aren't bringing, I know people of color, I don't know if you are, I'm sure you're aware that in clinical trials, one of the things you talk about, people of color aren't used in these clinical trials. So people are getting medicine that's not necessarily made for them. Can you talk about that for a second? That issue is really important.
Okay. Well, let me start by the health care and the med. Medical workforce. You know, you can go to see Dr. Joy Jones, and you know who's got an office in the neighborhood, right? But there's a 50% chance that if you got ill enough to be hospitalized, she does not have hospital privileges.
Wow.
So 50% of those few doctors, that is less than 3% are fired and don't have hospital privileges. Of the remaining 50%, half of them are at or near retirement age. So the numbers of African-American doctors are so small that if you have a personal experience like I do, the few that you would try to go and see are so
booked and
overwhelmed.
Yes.
You can't even, you know, I just talked to someone who's trying to get their mother to see one of the top gerontologists here in Philadelphia, and she said he's not taking any more patients. He, you know, they're overwhelmed. So that means that they don't even have the abilities to the height of their, you know, their capabilities because they're just overwhelmed. So we're in a real quagmire in that sense. And to the point of the clinical trials, only 10% of the people who are participating in research and conducting that research are African Americans, right? So we are in a real serious situation in that regard because the science, that and all of the studies, are, meaning that you can't, the science and studies have shown that you get better care and better outcomes when you're dealing with someone in a, who's a medical and health provider who has, who looks like you, right?
Well, I think also you're comfortable speaking with someone who looks like you. And that's not to say that because all black people aren't alike. That's what I want to say. All black people aren't alike. But I agree with you. And as you just said, there are studies that prove this, that I think I have a African-American woman PCP. And I do feel, lucky me.
You.
And she's actually won some awards, probably because she's overwhelmed and trying to treat everybody. But I do feel comfortable with her. Whereas I will say if I have a white male doctor that maybe she's not there that day and they have to come look at me, or an East Indian doctor that has to come in and look at me that day, or Asian
dynamic.
Woman has to come in. Recently I had a young resident I had to look. He was East Indian. And I could tell he was nervous. And, I mean, I was older than him, so I wasn't really nervous. But because of his nerves, then maybe he forgot something. Maybe he forgot to see something, or maybe he forgot to tell me something. So I think and it could be a number of reasons he was nervous, but I will say some of it could be cultural, you know, having to interact.
Well, a lot there's no
go ahead.
For cutting you off, but there's a lot of it that is speaking to directly to the culture, because joy in life, just in life in general, if you're dependent on someone for something very critical like providing your health care, if they don't stay where you stay, right, if they don't play in the places where you play, and if they don't pray in the places where you play, how do they know who you are?
Yeah.
Right? It's impossible. It's almost impossible. It's an impossibility. So the obstacle and the challenge that's required for a medical and health provider to overcome that is a very steep, steep climb. So we have to understand that that is something that can't be ignored. So going back to why rumors as lay people when we have to engage with the health.
Well, I agree with you. So that's why I had you on the show today, because I think the knowledge is power. I'm always preaching at all the different shows. I've done shows on prostate cancer, diabetes, asthma, sarcoidosis, multiple sclerosis, lupus. Actually, this coming Thursday, I'll be doing a Twitter chat about lupus with a board member and a lupus advocate and a person who has lupus to inform people about lupus because many people are not aware. But knowledge is the best power. If you don't know, you don't know. Sometimes you don't know, you don't know. But let's move on a little bit. I want to talk about aging. I don't consider myself old, but I noticed that I'm not as springy as I used to be. I don't know if that's a word or whatever, but I don't just jump up out the bed anymore. I do know if I the more frequently I exercise, if I maintain exercise, I feel better. If I eat certain foods, I feel better. You have a section about that, but there's no denying that your health does decline when you age. Yes.
Absolutely. And Joy, just to finish that last section, of when we talk about people of color and we talk about African-Americans, we got to put that in the context of African-American people versus black people. So you go into a doctor's office and there are six black people in there. Two of them could be Haitians.
Yes.
Two could be Africans. Two could be and two could be Jamaicans or whatever the configuration are. So
they could be Dominican too.
Totally,
they could be African Cuban or Afro Brazilian.
They could be Cuban.
Yes.
Exactly. So my point is that all of those are even different cultures. So the complexity of this cultural dynamic is like enormous. And when we're talking about healthcare and the way medicine is practiced and provided in this country right now, it is at such a high technological level. The technology that's required for doctors to practice medicine means that they have to be totally almost consumed and immersed throughout their entire medical education with just understanding the technology. They don't even have the luxury of factoring into
cultural sensitivity.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's why it is more than important that as patients, consumers, and lay people, we have to get as much good, solid information about the kinds of things that we're talking about in this book.
Well, I agree with you. And the thing is, and I think it has to start early, though. One of the things that I noticed working, I also work in for a healthcare company. I won't mention name, but many people are not empowered at a young age about the checkups and things they need to get. They're not many in the African American community. People don't want to talk about certain health issues because of shame or embarrassment. And again, going back to historically, African Americans didn't have access to the information.
Yes.
Because of their low standards in education, depending on where they lived in the country, and maybe not being able to read. I mean, I know Philadelphia, in terms of literacy, I think we have like 10%, 12% illiteracy rate in Philadelphia.
Absolutely. Well, that's on the very
conservative.
You're being
Okay.
very generous. Absolutely, very conservative. I think it's much higher than that. But
let's get to the aging. Let's
know,
talk. Let's talk
on,
a little bit about the aging.
Okay. Let me. Yeah. Well, so first of all, we don't understand. A lot of times, you know, one of the chapters, as you notice, is in the book, is, you know, am I sick or am I aging? And we are so removed from understanding our bodies, our health, and our entire lifestyles, diets, and behaviors that we don't even know the difference. A lot of these things and say, oh, man, my knees are killing me. You know, I guess, you know, I'm getting old. Instead of just, you're not getting old, you're dehydrated, and your joints and the cartilage are showing the effects of
you know that. What? That's so interesting because you were talking about that in the book about the issue of dehydration. You actually mentioned a couple times, and I don't think – I mean, I try to drink enough water, but I know I don't, and I think – when you do, like, well, I'll say you have to go to the bathroom more often. That's one thing. So you drink more.
Got a chapter in there on that.
But you do feel better. And, like, I tell my daughter, she's at school during the day at high school. They don't, you know, their water fountains, it's a public school, so it's not, like, the best of condition, but one of the better ones. But I tell her, get, you know, extra bottle of water. And she started carrying extra bottles of water because I said you get headaches if you're dehydrated. You
Absolutely.
Feel tired.
And
yeah,
to that point, we are as a country and a society, we're a dehydrated society, and the greatest evidence of that is that if you look at what the top over the counter medication are, all of them without exception are things that are used to address symptoms from dehydration.
Wow.
Everything from the antacids, the laxatives, the medicated shampoos, the ointments, the creams, the headache medications, the stuff we take for, you know, arthritis, strength, whatever, you know, pain relief, all of those are signs of dehydration.
Wow.
So instead of us being having the understanding and getting the kind of public health education that we should be getting, we're led to think that don't worry about it.
It's a big industry. I mean, people today believe that, you know, if you have AIDS, okay, you can live now. But then people also think they don't want to find a cure because they want to keep you hooked on these medicines. People believe there's a cure to cancer out there, but they don't want to come up, and I say the industry doesn't want to come up, you know, with a cure. People don't want to have, you know, everybody having health care. They think that's some crazy socialist, you know, going on to communist idea. But I'll tell the people, look, the euro is worth more than the dollar. And so that's all I have to say about it. They're over there doing whatever they're doing, and they have, you know, but the centralized healthcare, you know, system there, Canada also, their money is worth more than our money. So all the yak about if everybody has healthcare, oh no, nobody's going to have money. Sorry, out the window. You know.
Right. Well, but you know, Joy, as you mentioned, you know, at the beginning of the show, in your introduction, you talked about some of the work I do, passionate about, but I absolutely love what I do, and so much so that I feel that one day two guys are going to drive up in this black car and get out in black suits and ties and say, okay, buddy, enough. We finally caught you. You know? So I feel like I'm getting away to do this. But anyway, so I've been to places, you know, in Canada, and I've looked at the Canadian system, medical and health system. I've been probably almost 20 times I've been to Cuba, and I've been into parts of Europe, and I've looked at countries of all economic levels, from poor countries like Cuba to very rich countries, you know, that, you know, over in the Scandinavian countries and in Canada, and looked at how they approach health care. And it's a privilege. I mean, it's not a privilege. This is a right. And when those countries, what they do is understand that we have to make sure people are educated about health and lifestyle and diet. We have to make sure that they understand how their bodies work. And then they don't have these unsustainable health care budgets for the country. I mean, we spend $2.26 trillion in this country every year on health care. And 80% of that money is spent on chronic conditions, diabetes, high blood pressure, arthritis, obesity-related complications.
Things
right?
that could be
Things
avoided.
That are controllable and preventable with the proper kind of behavioral, lifestyle, diet changes, and education, right?
Let's talk about that issue of diabetes. That is a huge thing in the African-American community, and not only the community, but for the children. I had Dr. Ronnie Whitfield on talking about the number of overweight diabetic kids coming into his office and how it just pains him that these kids are having orthopedic surgery at 15, shooting up with insulin, type 2. This is mainly type 2 diabetes because some people do have type 1, and that's something that is a different ball game. But talk to me about your insights in the diabetes in the book. You go into that a little bit. Just talk to the audience about your thoughts about African-American community and the diabetes epidemic.
Yeah, particularly in African-American and black communities, is because we got to acknowledge the role that diet and lifestyle plays. We get into looking at broadening the population health context of this conversation are made available for children to eat, right? So we talk about the Chinese takeouts. We talk about the pizza places. We talk about,
don't forget about the little juicy juices and the 20 hugs on the store.
With school systems that don't offer or have.
My daughter used to take gym. My daughter had to take gym in high school. And I said, what do you mean? I remember I learned about, her curriculum. And, if I take it for these 2 years, then when I'm a senior, I don't have to take it anymore. I said, okay, didn't they come out with 60 minutes a day, every day is what exercise you need, and now you don't have. So this is the problem right there.
And so you see, this is like the genesis of that whole epidemic. Starts with those types of social, economic, and environmental kinds of factors. And then you add to that, you add it to looking at how the reinforcement is done through what the media with the marketing and the commercials do. I mean, in Europe, they, and Cuba and in Canada, it's forbid for them to advertise a place on television and include in the commercial that, oh, and you can get a toy with the Happy Meal.
Yes.
Or you can get, they don't allow
Germany and certain European countries. Yes, you know what? I learned about that in recent years also. People, unthinkable here to not have it.
Absolutely. And so when you stop it, we see those kinds of things happening. And then we say, well, wow, how come all these kids are now all of a sudden getting fat? I don't understand it. I didn't have that problem because we didn't have the same kind of scenarios that these kids are growing up in. Young people growing up primarily and specifically in these urban areas where the parents, if there are more than one, but, parents, whether it's one or two, are so overwhelmed with trying to survive and trying to work if they are able to have whatever. So the time is not even there for them to listen. And okay, it's dinner time and eat. Instead, it's like, okay, a phone call home to the latchkey biscuit and be sure to get your brother some coleslaw to go with it kind of thing. So, and this is the lifestyle.
But Glenn, people are going to say to you, where is the issue of self-control? I mean, are we the only ones that know that that's not good eating? The issue of not enough supermarkets in my neighborhood, not enough fresh fruits. Okay, and if they're in my neighborhood, they're too expensive. I can't afford them. And if I'm getting public assistance, if you talk about class issues, which you do talk about in your book, and that people of lower economic class are a greater risk for many of these diseases. On the flip side, I don't have access or they're too expensive. But then I've also had people say, you know what, you can eat the basics. You can get grains in the dollar store. You can get fruits, vegetables. Yeah, they may be more expensive, but that's okay. You think you have to eat all this meat and all this other stuff. You really don't. What's your thought about this is going into diet issues?
I don't really buy that argument, and I know I hear it. You can imagine how much I get hit with it when I'm speaking or doing things in different contexts and scenarios, and I don't buy it, and I adamantly kind of like push back against it because I say you can't put people in a social environment and make sure that 95% of the choices that they have around them in their daily life. We got to look at what the society has condoned. This is all taking place in the context of a society that still.
Okay, is that not crazy? I am so, oh my God, I'm so glad you said that. Advertise, market it. Even though now we do have little notes now saying, by the way, this could kill you, but go ahead, buy it. After you have
inundated the society with a product that contains one of the most addictive substances on earth, right, that you now say, oh, but by the way, here's a little note that says this can kill you. right? A product that is, this is not like something that if you misuse it or abuse it, it's deadly. This is something that is, if you use it appropriately and properly.
Wait, I like how you said that. Appropriately and properly.
Right. You know, use it exactly the way it's supposed to be used. Don't overdo, you know, just use it the way it's supposed to be used.
Yes.
It'll kill you. Okay? And this is legal. So I'm saying this now, I mean, this is really how really wide this problem is. This is not just a small kind of individual responsibility, a policy. This gets into legislation. This gets into government. Because these are the kind of institutions and parts of our society that have financial interest in seeing these things happen. So
people can resist. Yes.
It's you just can't of trying to survive and then say you got to still be responsible, which goes into another area which we have to admit that we don't want to, which is the mental illness.
Oh, wow,
right?
Gosh. That's a whole show right
that,
there.
That drives. That drives a lot of that stuff. You know, I was just, you know, talking with my friend Terry Williams in
Terry
New York.
Yes, Terry
was
on the show. Terry's been on the show also,
Yeah, with her book,
yes.
Black Pain. I mean, this is, like, enormous. Is. You know, people need to, you know, really, you know, that may be crazy, but I would think that my recommendation for her book, Black Pain, has a greater impact once we understand what we're going through and what we're feeling.
Well, I think that it's all connected. You agree.
Absolutely.
If you're having a mental health issue, that can affect what you're eating. That affects your physical activity.
You ain't thinking about no
right.
salad with extra
that
light dressing on it. You know, you want a burger, some extra large fries,
vice
and
versa,
a big goal.
Vice versa,
right?
Though, for the children. A lot of these children, and one of the things you talk about, the ADHD in there, the children and their diets affect their learning, their growth, their development, mentally, physically, and then also spiritually, if you want to go there. I want to talk about some prostate cancer, though. I want to talk about men because that's a big issue. I will tell you as a woman, I cannot tell you how many times I have to beg men in my life or even friends to go take care of their health. They do not want to go. What is that? You're a man. What's that deal?
Well, you know, when I was a little boy, you mentioned my southern roots and growing up in Birmingham, and my grandpapa used to always say that there are two places that black people need to stay away from, courts and
wow,
hospitals.
See? Mm-hmm.
Right. Fully and deeply ingrained in an aversion to being connected with those institutions,
but
because
day,
both
to
of
the
them.
Day, you feel that that is the case for, say, a 35-year-old or a 5-year-old African American man today is thinking.
Let me give you an example. I told you I grew up in Birmingham, right? So I was the seventh of nine children. I was the first child in my family that did not go to Tuskegee to go to college, right? So six ahead of me had gone that direction. So my science trips and field trips, you know, throughout my years growing up in elementary and high school were field trips to Tuskegee to see George Washington Carver's, you know, laboratory and all that sort of thing. So, of course, to hear about the Tuskegee experiments was devastating. I had my oldest sister is a retired registered dietitian, and she did her dietary studies in school at Tuskegee. She was an intern making the lunches for the men in the Tuskegee experiment who didn't even, she didn't know that what she was doing and they didn't know what they were doing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right? Really talking directly
about
what his experiences are like that, but I know him well enough to know he's got some mistrust and some suspicion as it relates to doctors. Now, that's not as important in terms of liability and personal responsibility as of the medical, the healthcare system, and this government to do something over these years to have addressed those kind of fears and anxieties.
Yeah, yeah.
Entire onus and the responsibility has been the left
individual.
On black men need to just go to
yes.
the doctor.
So you're talking
right?
about the
they
the macro issues. I mean, a lot of times people are focusing on the micro issue of the human, the being, the individual, and taking that personal responsibility because, you know, what I did, I'm aware of that, and but I still go and I try to do this and do that. But that's a small percentage. And as you mentioned earlier, there's only, you said 3% of African-Americans, medical doctors, and then half of that don't have, you know, board certified. So as an African-American man, do I want to go and speak to someone who's been who has a look and feel of my oppressor, if you want to put it straight? I mean, seriously, you know? I mean,
absolutely.
We have to put it straight like that, put it plain. Do I want to go as a black man to a white man in an intimate situation? Because I want to talk about this prostate cancer real quick. You have a controversy in here, your book about the PSA. Talk to the audience about your view about this PSA
well,
screening.
Listen, first of all, it's not my controversy. Don't shoot the messenger, right? No, I got you. I'm just kidding. But because here's the deal. Here's the deal that I think that, and this is why this book, Information is Best Medicine, is, you know, I really am passionate about this. I really feel that if I don't do anything else in life, I'm okay because I feel I did what I was supposed to do by getting to the point where I could get this book done and out there, right? But let me say this. I really want people to look at that, those chapters that I've written that address prostate cancer, as well as those cancers, the chapters that address breast cancer. And what we have to start to understand is the technology that has been promoted as being the absolute answer to saving our lives really doesn't do that.
That's what you're saying. Let me just read here. I was like, whoa, when I read this. It said, if you have a group of men diagnosed as a result of PSA screening, 30 to 40% don't need to know that they have prostate cancer because it's meaningless in terms of risk to their health. And for somewhere between 30 and 40% of men with prostate cancer, no matter what, quote, treatment is given, the disease is not curable. I mean, wow.
Just over the years that they've been doing this test, to look, they run the analysis and says, it don't really make a difference.
But then are you saying now, because, I mean, this is a kind of parallel to the women and getting mammogram screenings, how they're saying
the same thing. Joy,
yes.
Over the same period of time, from the time that they started the mammogram test until the time that these studies have been done, which is about 2010, if I'm not mistaken, 2010, mm-hmm. somewhere in there, they looked at it and said that the women who were getting regular mammograms over that period of time versus the women who were not getting it, the death rate was exactly the same.
But then, you know, people are going to say if they don't get anything at all and they delay, if they don't do monthly, like, I'm sorry, I'm switching over a little to the women issue, but they don't do monthly breast self-examination. So then they don't come until they start having symptoms similar with men, that they don't get any kind of regular screening, and that they don't come until it's too late. I mean, where's the balance?
Okay, here's what I believe is the deal. What I'm suggesting is that what we have to realize is happening is I have personal experiences with people very close to me and those who aren't so close to me, of men and women who have gotten a mammogram or who have done a PSA test, and that alone. Have made some decisions that have horribly altered their life. Double mastectomies, prostatectomies, chemotherapies, radiation, all kinds of things, which led to complications, you know, infections, and all, I mean, life-changing stuff. So what I'm saying is that what we have to understand is there's a practice of medicine and there's a comprehensive way to look at any situation, and particularly when we talk about breast and prostate cancer, so that with all the information available, then someone should be able to make a decision about what is the most appropriate treatment to pursue. And in the case of prostate cancer, once again, 30 to 40% of the men who get these PSA tests find out they have high levels of PSA, which is a prostate-specific antigen, which is a hormone that just shows the level of it. so and so. My PSA was like 12. So my doctor said I should, I got these three options. I can have it removed. I can do chemo. Or I can do radiation. And so I just told him, go on and take it out because I don't want to have to be thinking about it. The evidence, meaning.
Yeah. So you're saying it's more comprehensive that don't
that
just put all your eggs in one basket
exactly.
with this one test, I think.
And right now, and you may do a biopsy, and the doctor may say to you, Glenn, we found some cancer cells in your biopsy, in the tissue.
Okay.
And what that book, what the passage that you read in the book really speaks to is to say, that does not mean that it's enough cancer. That
wow. You're saying some radical stuff. You're saying some radical stuff, and yes. The men in the black limousine
and the beauty of what
come knocking on your door.
But let me say this to you. If you look on the back cover of my book, I was fortunate that I have two extremely respected medical doctors, Dr. Edward Cooper and Dr. Bruce Smith, who's the head of all clinical research at Jefferson Hospital, and Dr. Ed Cooper, who is the first African-American president of the entire National Heart Association, the first professor of medicine at University of
Japan. I said you had the big guns backing you so that, yes.
Well, not backing me. I just wanted to make sure that there was nothing that I could not, that I had in that book that could not stand up to the highest of medical scrutiny by anybody in the system on any side of it. Insurance, health care. I pride my people with trusted information. That's what I trusted information that they can understand. Because as you know, I'm not a doctor in I'm not a doctor. I just sound like one. But I want and it's true because what I want to do is I want to demystify the notion that we're not smart enough to be responsible and active participant in our health care. That we have to, I want to demystify that. I think that with enough of the basic information that's in that book, and that's why it's titled Information is the Best Medicine, because if you have that information, you can be an active participant in the game and not a spectator sitting up in the
booth. Well, we only have a few minutes left, so I want to go quick to the issue of asthma.
What?
Yeah, we talked about a lot, though, but asthma and children and cockroaches, this chapter caught my eye because, as I mentioned before we went on the air, that I did not know about the cockroach issue until a couple of years ago. My brother has asthma, and perhaps my parents might know about this issue with cockroaches. They probably do. They're little intellectuals themselves. But I don't think people are aware of this. I just want to read from your book here, talking about the issue of cockroaches and asthma. And people don't like to talk about this, and you start off the chapter with that, but. When most people think of allergy triggers, they often focus on plant pollens, dust, animals, and stinging insects. In fact, cockroaches also can trigger allergies and asthma. In the 1970s, studies made it clear that patients with cockroach allergies develop acute asthma attacks. The attacks occur after inhaling cockroach allergens and last for hours. Asthma has steadily increased over the past 30 years. It is the most common chronic disease of childhood. But because of cockroaches?
Absolutely. One of the most underreported factors in asthma. And when you stop and look at a city like rates of childhood asthma among African Americans in the country.
Wow.
You think about how old this city is and how many of those children that I just mentioned live in those houses. And how infested they are with cockroaches, and you see where a natural line is drawn from one point to another.
In your book you say 23% to 60% of urban residents with asthma are sensitive to the cockroach allergen. Now explain this cockroach allergen. Are you saying that it's their skin, it's their dropping? What?
Oh, yes, it's okay. All of the above, yes. Those are all the things that are, you know, a result of a cockroach, right? They shed, they have eggs, they have, you know, their own feces, all of those things, their saliva, all of those things are products of that insect, and they and it can then be become a trigger for asthma and asthmatic kinds of disorders.
So now, what do you suggest? Because people can't just move out of their houses, and when you live in the city, you live near restaurants, and there's trash, and I mean, so talk to us. What can be done?
That goes back to what I'm talking about. How we have to start to widen this argument and this conversation, and take it out of talking about do we.
Albuterol or something like that.
Should I get a pickups? And you know,
that's a big thing. That happens. That's happened all over.
Absolutely, but because we don't have the information, we don't see that that's a fight that we need to have. We need to talk about landlords and not to make sure that places have been exterminated and properly, you know, de-infested with regularity, so that there's not any type of colonies continuing to thrive and to grow. And so those are the kind of things that when I talk about policy and legislation that we're not even including in the conversation, because we have been convinced about where our focus needs to be based on what the industry and those who benefit from it determine is important to us based on marketing, advertisement, and those types
of things.
So
basically you're saying we've been hoodwinked and bamboozled. That's what you're
right. We've been hoodwinked, bamboozled, run amok, and led astray.
Well, Glenn Ellis, we do need to end the conversation today, but you have to come back on again. Your book, Information is the Best Medicine, A Guide to Navigating Your Healthcare, a must-have. I will give away some copies of your book to educate people because I think, again, knowledge is power. So if you're listening, you want to follow me on Twitter, at Joy Keys, and you want to become a fan on Facebook, just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, follow Glenn Ellis Sr. on Twitter and check out his website, glennellis.com. Now, Glenn, are you on Facebook also?
Yes, I am. I have a fan page at Glenn Ellis. You can go right to Glenn Ellis.
Okay,
on Facebook. And Joe, I want to make sure that your listeners know that this event.
Yes,
on
please
19th
mention the address and everything.
Mm-hmm. It's at the Pennsylvania Convention Center, 12th and Arch, room 107. The event is free. There'll be this a wonderful historic presentation about the health of African Americans in Philadelphia since 1790 all the way up to present. I'll be doing a book signing on this new book, and once again, all are welcome.
Yes, and I want to emphasize that issue of all. You know, we talked a lot about people of color today and African Americans, but this information can help anyone, Latino, Asian, Native American, you know, anyone can benefit from Glenn's book, and anyone can benefit, say, if you know someone who is of African-American descent, African descent or Afro-Cuban or wherever they may be, they can use this book. It's very easy to read. The chapters are very short, concise, and there's a lot of resources that he talks about. It's just giving you more information that you can go to your healthcare provider and challenge them. You know, make them work. You are paying premiums every month. Make these healthcare providers work for what you're paying for. Make the industry, you know, in terms of like he talked about the macro issues of trash pickup. Talk to your local council person. Talk to your local, you know, Senate, state rep, whatever. Talk to like, hey, this cannot happen because this affects children's health, you know, which affects their learning capability, their growth, development. This affects seniors. Just try to be proactive, and this book will empower you to be proactive with your health and the health of your community. So, again, thank you so much, Glenn.
Hey listen, Joy, I really commend you on the work you're doing, and I just am so proud of you. I've known you a long, long
since I was a
time,
young
but more importantly, before you were a whipper. This is before you had a snap, okay? But listen, Joy, your mother and father, as you mentioned, are tremendous intellectuals. Your mother was a phenomenal trailblazer. She gave vision to people like myself, and ultimately to your generation, that us being able to have a voice in the media and to really project positive information and images was possible. And I think that people like her, when we talk about Women's History Month, I want to do something to feature and focus on the contributions that your mother, Leanne Nurse, has made in this world. A lot of us are benefiting. We make things are smooth, and we've got a lot of good things going on. That's because people like your mother paved that road. Otherwise, it was a rough, rocky, bumpy road filled with potholes.
Oh, wow. She'll be so happy to
smooth,
hear that.
Thank you. The smoothness that we enjoy is because of the efforts and the sacrifices that people like
Well, just
make.
So the audience knows, my mom did work in media, so that does have some reason why I'm in media in a sense. And both my parents are very artistic, so I was also involved in art.
Absolutely. Your father's one of the most talented artists.
Yes, definitely. But thank you so much, Glenn, for coming on. And again, check out GlennEllis.com and check out Glenn Ellis Sr. on Twitter. Also, he's on Facebook. And go to his event next Sunday, February 19th. Tell me the time again is
3 o'clock p.m. in room
107. Okay, thank you so much. You guys have a wonderful Sunday.
Honey, put this on top of the minivan.
We're only going for 2 weeks. You want me to back the kitchen sink, too?
Well, is there room?
Hey, you guys. You going on vacation?
Who's that?
I don't know.
Because we're planning on robbing your house tonight.
All right, I'm calling an alarm service.
Wouldn't it be great if you could be warned of life's risks? If you have diabetes, you can. There's a simple blood test called A1C that can help measure your risk of complications from diabetes. Why is it important? Because more than 600 people every day die from diabetes and its complications. If your A1C is above 7, your doctor can show you how to lower it. If you have diabetes, know your risk. Know your A1C. Ask your doctor, or for more information, go to www.diabetesa1c.org or call 1-877-TEST-A1C. Brought to you by the American Diabetes Association, Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation International, and the Ad Council.